ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! This Working Life on ABC Radio National and anytime on ABC Listen.
Hello, Damien Carrick here. This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. A warning, today we will be discussing voluntary assisted dying, suicide and mental health issues. The recent death of a 25-year-old paraplegic woman in Spain gained worldwide attention after she was granted access to euthanasia despite a legal challenge by her father. Her case raised questions including, should the procedure only be allowed if there is a terminal illness? Should eligibility include mental distress? And how does mental illness impact on the idea of agency and choice? In countries where euthanasia is allowed, there are very different legal frameworks. To talk about this, I'm joined by Jocelyn Downey, a research professor in the Faculties of Law and Medicine at Dalhousie University in Canada. Kenneth Chambert, Professor of Public Health, Sociology and Ethics of the End of Life at Ghent University and the Free University of Brussels, both in Belgium. And Ben White, Professor of End of Life Law and Regulation at the Queensland University of Technology. All three spoke at a conference on assisted dying and other end-of-life care at QUT this month. Ben, if I can start with you, how many countries have some kind of voluntary assisted dying or VAD scheme?
There's about 17 countries which have some form of voluntary assisted dying. That could be practitioner administration, where the person is assisted by a medical practitioner who actually administers the medication, or self-administration, which is where the person takes it themselves. And we anticipate that over time that number will increase. We've seen efforts to change the law in the UK and Scotland. Both of them recently did not progress, or the UK is still considering before Westminster. But we anticipate that trend of liberalisation of permitting voluntary assisted dying across the world will continue.
Let's talk about sort of three different approaches, bearing in mind that there are many different approaches. Australia has a narrow approach, Belgium a broader approach, and Canada an evolving approach. Ben, who is eligible for voluntary assisted dying in Australian states and territories?
There is an Australian model, which, as you say, is relatively narrow. We actually have seven different jurisdictions within Australia which have voluntary assisted dying laws. It's only the Northern Territory, which has not yet got a law. So when I talk about the Australian model, there is some variation state by state. But broadly, we are talking about adults who are Australian citizen or resident of the state. They have to have decision-making capacity and be freely and voluntarily making the decision to access VAD on an enduring basis. They have to have an advanced illness that will cause death and is causing intolerable suffering. And often that is accompanied, and generally that's accompanied by a time frame expected to death. So in most states, it is 6 months, except if it's a neurodegenerative condition, then it's 12 months. In Queensland, it's 12 months for all, and the ACT has chosen not to have a time limit, but folks seeking a voluntary assisted dying must still be approaching the end of their life. And each of those eligibility criteria is assessed by two health practitioners.
And who administers the drug? Does the patient have to swallow the drug themselves, or can it be administered as an injection by a healthcare professional?
In Australia, both self-administration, whether the medication is taken by the person themselves, or practitioner administration, where it's administered by a health practitioner, are permissible. One of the things that's different across the states is that the law sometimes has different defaults, if you like. So in places like Victoria and South Australia, self-administration is what people are entitled to. Unless they can't digest or take the medication themselves, then they're entitled to practitioner administration. Whereas in other places like the ACT or New South Wales, there is a more open choice.
Okay, so Victoria started the ball rolling in 2017, and since then everywhere except the Northern Territory, where it could well come into being later this year, now have voluntary assisted dying schemes. What are the numbers? How common is voluntary assisted death in Australia?
The data we have is up to the 30th of June last year, and there's been over 7,000 people across the various jurisdictions who have died after choosing to access voluntary assisted dying. This is a relatively small cohort. It's approximately 2% of deaths. That varies a little bit by jurisdiction, but when you look at the national picture, it's about 2% of total deaths.
Okay. As we've been hearing, voluntary assisted dying legislation has been rolled out across Australia since 2017. In Belgium, euthanasia has been legal since 2002. Kenneth Chambert, who is eligible for voluntary assisted dying in Belgium? It's a much broader cohort of people.
First of all, people don't have to be in a terminal stage. You can just be an incurable illness. So that means no life expectancy requirements. That's already a big difference, I think, with a lot of countries. And the person should also be suffering unbearably, and that can be physically, but also psychologically. So there's also scope for people with psychiatric conditions to access euthanasia, as we call it, of course. And of course, suffering needs to be irremediable. That's also a very core requirement of our law. But you can see already that we have a more progressive or more open approach to assisted dying. And also, I think importantly, in 2014, we had an amendment that allowed assisted dying or euthanasia for minors without an age limit. So everything came down to the illness of the person, of the minor. In that case, the minor needs to have a physical condition, so a physical ailment. And there are also some extra legal requirements on top of that.
So what are the numbers, Kenneth? How many people choose euthanasia in Belgium? What percentage of deaths?
Well, just last week we got the report for 2025 for the number of reported cases. The total was 4,486 cases. And in Belgium, that translates into around 4% of all deaths. So a little bit higher than Australia, but definitely not the highest in the world. And maybe important for context, this is still a rising number compared to 2024. We saw an increase of 12%. So we're also still evolving in terms of numbers.
And what are the numbers for people who ask for euthanasia because of unbearable mental suffering? So I guess because of mental illness or psychiatric illness.
Yes, so just people with psychiatric conditions, not counting people with dementia, because that's also a possibility in our country. We're about 1.6% of all assisted dying cases. So that translates into about 50 cases per year, and it fluctuates from year to year. So there's not really an increasing trend there, because there's also, I think, a lot of reluctance among physicians and health care practitioners to engage in that specific practice.
There have been a number of cases that have attracted attention. There was the case of deaf twins who were going blind, and they were distressed at the prospect of becoming blind and the loss of connection with each other and with the world that would accompany this disability. They were able to obtain euthanasia. Well, was that case controversial in Belgium?
Somewhat, I would say somewhat controversial, but it didn't progress, let's say, onto a legal level like some other cases have, just stirred a lot of public interest. So we're talking about the Verbessem twins, like you said, deaf twins who were going blind as well, so who are losing every meaningful connection, let's say, with the outside world, but also with themselves. And that's a very peculiar aspect with this case, is that they had what we call duo euthanasia. And it is rare, but it happens also, for instance, in older couples who choose to die together. And it was losing connection with the outside world, but especially also losing connection with each other. And this was something that caused for them unbearable, irremediable suffering. And so, let's say the legal criteria were met, but of course, these are kind of fringe cases or frontier cases that do stir up a lot of discussion. Yeah.
Well, speaking of cases which did actually proceed to the courts, there was also the very interesting case of Godelieve de Troyes, who chose euthanasia, and sort of an elderly woman, because she was living with depression. And her adult son only found out about her death when he was contacted by the morgue to collect her body. And he took the state of Belgium to the European Court of Human Rights, arguing that the euthanasia framework of the country breached her right to life. What did the court find?
Well, the court did find that there was no real breach or no discernible breach in law because in our euthanasia law, there is no requirement for the family to be involved in any way. So the person can actually block that off completely. And again, we don't know a lot about individual cases, specific cases. But when that happens, it's often because you know that the family will not be supporting your request or there is some kind of troubled relationship between the family members. So that's also why it's not specifically in our law. Now, having said that, I think the vast majority of cases do happen with the involvement of family, not in terms of decision making, but at least being involved in the process to some extent. And so this case was also very instrumental, I would say, to have this debate about what is the place of the family and looking beyond what is in law and trying to translate how does that go into practice without also damaging, let's say, the interests or the lives of others who are involved. So that really was something that was stirred by this case. And maybe another peculiarity of this case was that, and that was also something that came up in the court case, that the provider, so the physician who provided the euthanasia, was also the chair of the euthanasia committee who needed to look over this case. So there was kind of this conflict of interest. And this is kind of an old sore for us in Belgium. It's still the case. And there are, let's say, ways that the committee goes about this, but it's definitely not the ideal situation.
Yeah, the court found that there was no breach of the right to life, but the judges did call on more safeguards and highlighted the fact that the head of the review board was the doctor involved in this woman's death and there was a conflict of interest or a muddying of the waters there. It goes to the importance of processes and safeguards, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. And there's only so much you can write into law. That's actually the debate that's going on still in Belgium. Do we need to amend the law or do we need professional guidelines or maybe deontological guidelines even that kind of help structure the practice to ensure safe practice? And like I said, it's an ongoing debate. Like in assisted dying globally, there are two sides, opposing sides and the more progressive people. And the discussion is there openness or let's say not thwarting access too much, but also making sure that there's no misuse or abuse of our law.
Okay, so in Belgium, there seems to be a long-standing consensus around the availability of euthanasia. In Australia, we have a relatively recent slow rollout across all our various states and territories, starting in 2017 in Victoria. In Canada, in contrast, there was, I think, a Supreme Court of Canada decision that required all parts of the country to introduce euthanasia schemes. And that happened in 2015, and this led to the passing of, in 2016, of Canada's National Medical Assistance in Dying Law. Jocelyn Downey, what is the test for accessing MAID or Medical Assistance in Dying in Canada as a result of this Carter and Canada Supreme Court decision?
Right, so you have to have a grievous and irremediable medical condition causing enduring and intolerable suffering that cannot be relieved by means acceptable to the patient. That's the language from the Supreme Court of Canada decision, which gave us what we call MAID. You call VAD here. Everybody has their own term. But they established the boundaries for access. And you're right to point out that for us, it's federal because our criminal law is federal, unlike Australia, where you do this at the state level. So the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that the prohibition on assisted dying was contrary to our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and so struck it down, and that's what gave us our assisted dying law.
And so the test under this 2016 legislation was you can access MAID when natural death is foreseeable, but that test has subsequently been widened, I think, in 2021. What does it now allow?
Yeah, so we have to understand it as sort of a back and forth between the courts and parliament. So the Supreme Court of Canada said you must allow MAID when you meet the criteria that I said just a couple of minutes ago. And then the federal government, in response to that, introduced legislation that was narrower. And I think that's what you're alluding to, where you mentioned natural death has become reasonably foreseeable. What they did was they took the expression grievous and irremediable medical condition and narrowed it by saying your natural death has to have become reasonably foreseeable. What then happened was we went back to court because that wasn't consistent with the Carter decision, went back to court and said, no, that natural death reasonably foreseeable is too narrow, it violates the Charter. And a Quebec court said, yes, you're right, it's gone now too. So we're back out to the Carter provisions. Federal government then comes back and says, okay, well, we're going to be close to Carter, but we're going to have a temporary exclusion of mental illness as a sole underlying condition. So that's where we sit now, which is we're almost back to Carter, but we have this temporary exclusion of mental illness as a sole underlying condition.
And I believe that in 2027, there's a requirement, and I'm not sure where this requirement comes from, but that will actually broaden accessibility to include people who have suffering as a result of mental illness. Is that right?
Yeah. So the legislation includes a provision that's an automatic repeal of that exclusion. So that's why I was describing it as temporary. They put it in to say we need time to get ready for MAID for people with mental illness as their sole underlying condition. And then they extended it again. So now we're at 2027 as the time when that should be automatically repealed. It's important to recognize that it's not an expansion of the law, in that what this would do in March of 2027 is simply take us back to the boundaries of Carter, which is the Supreme Court of Canada saying this is what the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms requires.
What are the numbers in Canada? What percentage of deaths are a result of euthanasia?
So we're at about 5.1% of deaths now. So that's 16,499 was our last annual number. And so, yeah, we're at 5.1% of all deaths.
Is there an alternative? I mean, do people sometimes feel that they may be a burden on their families or on society and can't access the support they need? And this means that they perhaps see voluntary assisted dying or MAID or euthanasia as their best option, rather than allow VAD for people experiencing psychological distress. Would it be much better to invest in mental health services and treatments, social support, secure housing, these sorts of things, rather than simply rely on, quote unquote, the agency of the person who finds themselves distressed?
Well, one of the things that's fascinating is the data is very clear that socioeconomic vulnerability, marginalization, lack of access to supports and services, those are not drivers of requests for MAID. It's quite the opposite. So what people speculated and said might happen, and this was a concern, is not being borne out by the data. So what that means to me is, A, that's not a reason not to allow MAID for people with mental disorders as their sole underlying condition, but B, we still have an obligation to improve supports and services for people who either need disability supports and services or mental health supports and services. Absolutely. We also have a need to provide better welfare supports and services, all social supports and services. We need to do them both at the same time. It's just that independent of MAID, we want to improve social services in our country. But the lack of access to supports and services is not a driver of requests for MAID. So it's not a reason not to allow it.
And we should also always be focused on making sure that our processes and checks and balances in terms of the approval and the carrying out of these sorts of things are always a focus.
Absolutely. And they are robust in all of our jurisdictions. And the other thing is, and it goes back to a point Kenneth made about how much should be in law and how much should be in practice guidance and so on, because you have to remember this is situated in a context of clinicians are delivering this. Clinicians have a built-in desire to take care of people and not to provide something like end of life to someone who shouldn't be getting it. that's already a check on the system. And then you build on top of that the procedural safeguards that we have and clinical practice guidelines and so on. And so people really are very well protected, I would say, in all three of our systems.
I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. Today we're talking about voluntary assisted dying. My three guests are three legal experts, Canadian Professor Jocelyn Downey, Belgian Professor Kenneth Chambert and Australian Professor Ben White. Look, so far we've been talking about terminal illnesses, pain and suffering, including mental illness. In all these situations, the patient affirms their choice immediately before death. Another contentious area is whether or not voluntary assisted dying should be permitted for patients diagnosed with dementia who make an advanced will, specifying that at a point in their decline, they will want to access voluntary assisted dying. Kenneth, I understand that in the Netherlands and soon in Belgium, it is possible for euthanasia to be administered to patients with dementia in this way. How did that come about? There was a court case in the Netherlands, I believe.
I'm not the expert in the Netherlands, but of course we are very close to them. And I can say a little bit about that. So actually it's been a possibility under Dutch law from the beginning. So one could request assisted dying or euthanasia, also as they call it in the Netherlands, beyond being competent based on advanced requests. And of course, with advanced dementia, that's a very important mechanism, let's say. So it's always been possible and there's always been, and this is, well, not surprising, but it's interesting to note that there's always been very few cases. It's very, very rare in the Netherlands. It amounts to a handful of cases per year. And especially as there's been a few cases under the spotlight, let's say, also reviewed by the committees, by the review committees. And so, can't say too much about the specific cases, but there are, as one could imagine, some practical considerations, some practical difficulties in executing or administering euthanasia beyond the competence of the person. One thing is that the person can be very reluctant or can not understand what is happening when the administration occurs. And some physicians have found ways around that, but not always very elegantly. So that's something that has stirred debate in the Netherlands.
Yeah, I understand that what happened was there was a doctor who his patient had signed an advanced will, I think, 4 years previously. And 4 years down the track, he administered euthanasia. He was charged, I think, with murder or some serious criminal offence. In 2019, he was acquitted. And there was a subsequent Supreme Court of the Netherlands ruling to clarify that what took place was legal. I understand that Belgium currently has a law before its parliament that would allow for a similar state of affairs in Belgium. Is that the case?
Well, yes, I think that's where, let's say, the legal debate is going to. I wouldn't say it's currently before parliament, but we have a major step, let's say, in fact that it is now in the government's policy plan. It's a bit of a wait and see for everyone involved in this debate.
And Jocelyn, I understand that Quebec has passed a law approving advanced made requests, so to kind of allow for this kind of scenario. Is that correct?
It is. They passed legislation under their health power, because the criminal law is federal, as explained earlier, but health is provincial. And so they passed legislation that would allow people in advance of loss of capacity to make a request and spell out the circumstances in which they would want to have made at a time when they no longer have decision-making capacity. And that's been in place for about a year now. And it's very supported across the country. The rest of Canada wants it. The majority of Canadians want advance requests. It's one of the things we most agree on, actually. It's interesting to see. We don't yet have it at a federal level. The federal government is being pressed to legislate and to follow Quebec, but we'll have to wait and see whether they'll do that.
Now, that's not on the agenda here in Australia. But Ben, you've been looking closely at issues around the extension of euthanasia into this area. What are some of the practical and ethical issues that come to mind?
You're right, Damien, that in Australia, the law, because of the requirement to both have decision-making capacity but also be at the end of life, sometimes 6 or 12 months, those two factors in combination mean that access to voluntary assisted dying on the basis of dementia isn't permitted here. But there are sustained public calls for this issue to be considered, and we do need an Australian evidence base. I think some of the challenges are those that we've spoken about. Advanced requests, by definition, require a trigger, require a decision point for the operationalising of that advanced request, and that requires careful thought and planning about what that would be. The work that's coming out of Quebec, I think, will be very, very instructive for Australia and indeed other countries to think about this. They've put a lot of time and thought into trying to make sure that that decision point is articulated as clearly as it possibly can be. One of the other challenges is willingness of doctors to participate. That can be a barrier in some instances. Some of those issues may possibly be able to be addressed if there is confidence in that decision point. If there's clearly documented evidence about the sorts of clinical situations or clinical manifestations that a person would regard their decision to come into force.
Because as people's cognitive abilities decline or communication abilities decline, they might still have a strong desire to live or even a change of heart from their previous position. These are, you know, very complex issues.
I agree. I mean, these questions about whether you are the same person before or after, these have been debated for decades. I think one of the responses to that is that not everyone will choose to make an advance request. If that is something, if retaining that decision-making authority after you've lost decision-making capacity is important to someone, that is a path they may choose to take. There may be others who say, maybe I'll be okay with that, and as a result don't wish to try and put those instructions in place. So yes, difficult ethical questions, and I think the challenge is to have an evidence-based response that tries to capture in a legal framework what those possibilities might be.
In conclusion, we've been talking about a range of different legal systems and a range of different cultures, and even different cultures within a single country. Belgium, Holland, the consensus seems to be largely that we should have an expansive concept of euthanasia. In Canada, the situation is evolving, and some places like Quebec are maybe more down a certain path. And then coming back to Australia, where are we heading, Ben?
The current voluntary assisted dying system is very well accepted. There's a high degree of public confidence and trust, and research shows that voluntary assisted dying is well integrated into end-of-life care in Australia. Probably the issue for consideration, given that the systems are operating safely, is the access question. There's some barriers in terms of the complexity of the process, finding willing doctors, institutions that might object, so not allowing voluntary assisted dying on premises, and indeed even people being aware that voluntary assisted dying is a legal choice. In terms of next steps, each of the states has to undertake a review of their voluntary assisted dying laws. This was embedded in the legislation, and two of those states, Victoria and Western Australia, have already done that. And I think what we'll see, at least in the immediate short term, is the opportunity for states to learn about how other states are working. So we have a broad Australian model, but there is some variation across the country. And we saw that with some recent reforms in Victoria, which was the first and took the most narrow and conservative approach in terms of its design of its VAD system. It's picked up some of the things that happen in other Australian states. Still, the voluntary assisted dying law is safe there, but it enhances access. For example, 12 months instead of 6 months expectation to death. So I think in the immediate short term, we will see other states learning from that national experience as they undertake those reviews.
Professor Bed White from the Queensland University of Technology, Professor Jocelyn Downey from Dalhousie University in Canada, and Kenneth Chambert from University of Ghent and Free University Brussels in Belgium. Thank you all for speaking to the Law Report.
Pleasure. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for this week. Do follow the Law Report on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and also to audio producer this week, Carey Dell. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.